Welcome to the Weekly Juice Podcast, where we discuss all things real estate, personal finance, investing, and entrepreneurship. Whether this is your first time here or you're an avid listener, we're thrilled to have you as a part of our community. Our goal is to share stories of successful entrepreneurs and investors in the hopes that they assist you along your journey towards financial freedom. We discuss successes, failures, systems, motivations, experiences, tips and tricks, and key lessons learned over time. After each episode, you should feel motivated, empowered, and prepared to take action in your own life. Make sure to tune in every Wednesday to get your weekly juice. You can also find us on Instagram at Weekly Juice Pod, where we post daily content, personal finance tips, and document our own journey towards financial freedom.
Welcome back to the Weekly Juice Podcast. As always, it's your boys, Ryan and Corey, here with another episode for you. Today, we had on a very special guest, Matt Faircloth. He's the founder and CEO of the DeRosa Group. He is a full-time real estate investor and author of Raising Private Capital, Building Your Real Estate Empire, Using Other People's Money, published by Bigger Pockets. He is an all-star in the real estate game, dropped a ton of knowledge on us throughout the episode, and really walked us through the process of using other people's money to fund real estate deals, which we know a lot of people have had questions about.
Yeah, it's not often that you get to talk to somebody who's been in real estate for 20 years plus and who really started out, he said, besides his first deal, right after that, he started using other people's money to scale his portfolio. So he taught us a lot. You don't have to be this like big time real estate investor to start to use other people's money to really leverage and build your portfolio. And he really walked us through his deal specifically and how you would get into it and how you would do it if you were trying to scale. There's not a lot of better people in the real estate game to talk to than Matt Faircloth. Like, he just broke it down so simply. He's got almost 2,000 units himself now and started investing before the real estate crash. So, you know, the guy really knows what he's doing here.
Couldn't agree more. He was a breath of fresh air and kind of firecracker right off the gate, just getting into facts and starting walking us through his story. So without further ado, I think we should dive in and bring in Matt. Matt, officially welcome to the Weekly Juice Podcast. Corey and I are thrilled to have you on the show. Recently finished your book, Raising Private Capital. I have it right here, published by Bigger Pockets.
So thank you.
You're welcome. We've had the number one question we've had on our show is, hey, I don't have any money of my own, or I spent all the money of my own on a real estate investment deal. How do I use someone else's?
And how do I
use
private capital? I ain't got no money. How do I go get money, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's I mean, unless you're born with a silver spoon in your mouth or a country club membership or an Ivy League, you know, family lineage or whatever, you're not going to have unlimited or one lottery, right? You're not going to have unlimited money. So at some point, every real estate investor or somebody growing a business is going to need to go out and get money from their network to put into their business.
Absolutely. Yep. So that's why we figured we'd bring the expert yourself on the show and interview to you today, not only to go through your story and just walk us up the ladder and how you've amassed the, I believe it's an over a 300 unit portfolio yourself, and then also how you raise private capital, right? And the ins and outs of everything.
I hate the unit count conversation. Well, mine is larger. My unit count is bigger than your unit count, but we are, you know, to not discount my company, we're at 1300 right now.
Whoa. Oh, wow. We had old info.
Old info.
No, I gotta update that. Like I've seen stuff. It's tough to keep that up, you know, because it's when you get to be a reasonable company, things move constantly. You're always buying, selling, moving stuff up. We'll be over 2,000 in the next month and a half.
That's incredible scale. Wow.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's easy to do when you're buying apartment buildings. You know?
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Boom. There it is. You know?
Absolutely. Well, with that, give us a brief background just on like who you are, where you're from, then how you got into real estate investing, and I kind of build us up to your portfolio now.
Cool. No problem. So Matt Faircloth, grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, went to Virginia Tech, go Hokies, just followed my job around at the time, was a traveling engineer, working as a sales, like a sales rep doing traveling consultations and stuff like that. Then ended up landing in Philly, for a lot of reasons, and met an awesome woman, who was so awesome and thought I was awesome too, that she put Rich Dad Poor Dad in my hand, as this traveling engineer. And I'm like, it's a good book. Let me read it. So her and I ended up playing cash flow together, and ended up like, hey, this is amazing. So we started going to real estate meetings and started to really got into this guy, just started checking out real estate together while we were dating. And I was renting a house in Manayunk, you know, down by where both of y'all are from, live right behind Thomas's and, you know, the Bayou, all that down there. Yep. Lived right there by in the middle of all that mess. And was renting, and my landlord put their house up for sale. We tried to buy the house. We couldn't because we got beat on pricing. The realtor felt for me and said, you know, let me help you. So help me find a property out in Conshohocken. And my two roommates, which are, you know, two knuckleheads like I was at the time, that just didn't know what to do, like didn't know where to go. So they just moved with me. They were both paying $500 a month like I was living in Manayunk. I bought a house in Conshohocken and my mortgage was $940 a month, right? Those two guys paying me $500 a month each, like I was, each paid me $500. And my my total mortgage was $940. I was making $500 a piece from them. So I was making $60 a month and living there for free while I had a full-time day job. So, you know, making a good earned income from them, right? So that was my first real estate investment. It was not called this at the time, but you know what they call now a house hack, right? So that was my first rental, and that just turned my head to the possibility of real estate. And in 2 years, paid off all my student loans, all my credit cards, all my everything. I took all my money and just directed it towards just getting myself out of bad debt. And it was a phenomenal venture, just kind of cleaned up my financial house that by the time Liz and I got married, was able to completely, unwind all my bad debt and got really tuned into real estate. So much so that my wife and I decided that when we got married, that we would live off of her income and I would build our real estate business. Fast forward to lots of bumps. That was 2005. Fast forward to lots of bumps in the real estate business. Fast forward to lots of ups and downs. The 2008 crash, all that mess, the 2010 and forward real estate run up to today. And then here we are, and we've raised a lot of money for real estate deals and done a bunch of apartment building deals and a bunch of flips and everything like that. And we've probably raised, I'm not sure how much money we've raised, but it's in the at least $30-$50 million range, somewhere in there, for our real estate ventures up till now.
Matt, that's an awesome story. It's actually really funny because your story started out so very similar to how mine started out. I did the exact same thing in purchasing a house hack and brought my buddies who were renting with me the same thing. I'm just hoping to see if the middle of my story can end up a little bit more like the middle of your story.
There's a lot of middle,
I'm a little bit behind
the middle there.
I'm a little bit behind you, but I think the question that, you know, you are known to the real estate community as like the raising private capital guy. I mean, you got the book right behind you, and obviously, you know, really what you're doing in that space. So the question that I have is, like, as you were starting to scale your portfolio, where was the inflection point for you where you went from, okay, I'm going to save up my money to purchase another rental or however you did it, to, oh, no, I'm going to start using other people's money? And how did that even start out for you? How did you get involved in it at that time?
How to get into raising money?
Yeah. Like, how did you go from, did you start your portfolio from saving up your own and then switch? Like, at what point did you switch over to raising money? Like, how did that work?
No, I've always bridged OPM. We bought a duplex. I mean, I wrote my own check for that little 3-bedroom, 1-bath that I bought in Conshohocken. But my first rental that we didn't live in was, as we talked about offline, was over in East Falls, right? I borrowed $30,000 from my girlfriend's dad at that time, right? From my future father-in-law. I borrowed $30,000 from him to buy that duplex. And then as we got going, I mean, we refied a lot. I mean, this was back in 2005, 2006, 2007, where the market was going up. You know, I'd probably buy a property for $200,000 and it'd be worth $250,000 in 6 months. I mean, just everything was going up, 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 up. So we refied a lot to get capital to do new deals, but we also relied on private capital right from Jump Street. We had a couple of immediate family members, which I talk about in my book, about start with people that like and trust you because you're you, not just some website like, you know, passiveinvestor.com or something like that. There is no such a thing, right? You got to start with people that like and trust you because you're you, which I did. And I had two family members that owned real estate free and clear. And I showed them how that free and clear real estate was a bank account that was just sitting there earning them nothing. that I just said, hey, listen, why don't we do something together where I can borrow against that free and clear real estate and we can win together and you can help me build my business and all that. Right. So that we scaled up that way, did a lot of fix and flips, did some rentals and things like that, and just, you know, scaled. And then it fast forward through the downturn and stuff. And the real like light bulb went off. So the short answer to your question is friends and family in the very beginning and our own capital from refinances. That's how we scaled. Then my wife had a colleague that she went to college with that she was connecting with at a networking event. And he fast forward was a financial planner after college. And it's like, hey, my husband and I are doing rental properties, whatever. And he says the magic words that you want to hear somebody say. And the magic words are, man, I wish I could invest in real estate too, but I just don't have the time. Right. And it's like, ding. And if you talk about real estate enough in your network, people are going to say that because not everybody has the time. People think that this is something they wish they could do, but they can't because of all the things that they believe are in their way to prevent them from getting into the space. Then those are the magic words because it's like, well, I have time, you know, for money, I have time if it enables me to do more deals, I will forego watching Netflix to go find more opportunities to grow my business. And I'll do things that people aren't willing to do to create more time in my life so that I can go do deals. Right. So, this colleague of hers from college got together and figured out a way for him to put 50 grand into my very first private capital deal. And off we went. And then he told his friends about it. And then one of my old drinking buddies from back in the day that I used to knock back some beers at the Bayou and was in a dart league at back in Manayunk, you know, one of those guys decided to throw some money at it because he, fast forward from going from playing in a dart league with me in Manayunk, had graduated up and became a dentist, right? He had some extra cash. So he wanted to put it to work. So, and he started putting it in deals with me as well. So that was our first, of our first couple of groups of deals. And it just grew and grew and grew organically. And then before you know it, you've got a conversation you can point back to say, hey, look at these four deals that I've done with these passive investors. And I was able to shine a spotlight on those. And that was able to draw us more and more attention.
Matt, maybe you could walk us through the structure of how some of these early private money deals worked for you, because you're really a testament to like putting in the work, but then just kind of spider webbing it through like you talking to other people, right? Like it's not like this magic bullet, right? You're just like, you're doing the work and you're telling people about it. It's working for them. They're telling more people about it. That's what it sounds like. So maybe I know a lot of our listeners are newer investors are probably at the point where they're looking to start to raise some money. What is a structured, maybe beginner type-ish deal look like if you're trying to raise money from somebody that maybe a family member or something like that?
Yeah. Unfortunately for those watching, it's likely not going to be a 150 unit apartment complex in downtown Dallas, right? Like a lot of people and a lot of people online are telling you that should be your first real estate deal. No, it should not be. That's a great way to go bankrupt is to buy a property like that first time out of the gate, right? My first property with the guy she went to college with was two single family homes in Trenton, New Jersey, right? Two little beaters that we went in and fixed up, just C-class rentals. And we're still a C-class landlord, by the way. And I believe C-class is the way to go personally. But we got in, fixed them up, made them really, really nice, for C-class. I call it workforce luxury, and 50 grand in equity, 50 grand in a private loan for someone from 50 grand from a self-directed IRA from one friend of mine and 50 grand in equity from this colleague of my wife's. And that was the deal. Everybody listening knows people with money that has 50 grand in an IRA or 100 grand in an IRA or has some extra cash they don't know what to do with. You talked about structure. One thing I should note as well, the equity partner was active. And that's one thing that's a misunderstanding is that if you bring somebody in with equity, it immediately has to be an SEC trigger, you know, and that like, oh, well, the SEC has to get involved and I'm going to get audited and it's got 506B, 506C. Yes, unless they are active. And if they're active, then they're not. If it's only through your efforts, you know, the venture that you're in, then yeah, it's passive. But if it doesn't have to be a passive investment for them, like my guy was keeping the books and that took him like an hour a month. And he was also personal guarantee on the mortgage. Those things right there made it active. And that makes it not a security. He was a partner, which is different. Partnership and equity are two different things. And that is a big I go over that in the book a lot, but that is a big understanding that your listeners need to take in. And it's also more intriguing to equity investors in the beginning that, hey, not just don't you want to invest in my real estate business? That's one thing versus, hey, do you want to partner with me? I found this deal. Do you want to partner up together? You know, I can make it super easy for you, put in an hour or two a month. I'll do all the legwork. You provide all the capital. You do a little bit of work, just enough, you know, so you can be active and see where the money's going. But we can partner up together. That's more intriguing, isn't it?
Totally. Totally. Yeah. I think that's a really good point. And thank you for breaking that down for me. As we go through like the how-to of the private money, I'd like to touch on your portfolio a little bit. And you mentioned C-class, and that's, you think that's the way to go. So I'm curious about, what is there a specific regional market that you're investing in, mm-hmm. as you grow your portfolio? Why C-class? Kind of what's the price range? Like, what are you looking at? I know that's definitely changed over time, obviously, but like, what does it look like as you were building it? And maybe what does it look like now?
Mm-hmm. It's changed a lot because we started building heavy in 2002 is my first rental property. 2012 when we started, in 2012-13 is when we started getting into like, you know, smaller multi-housing.
Yeah, maybe talk
and
about
the market's
that
changed completely. Yeah. What's that?
I said maybe talk about that time period as you started getting into small multi. That would be.
Yeah. Heavy. Yeah. Well, you quite asked something earlier, which I really want to underscore. We are market specific. I will not do a deal anywhere in the continental United States. And I think it's a mistake to come out that way, to come out of the gate that way, to say, I'll do a deal anywhere. You know, we don't do that. My company is active in three markets. That's it. You know, Lexington, Kentucky, Winston-Salem, Piedmont Triad, North Carolina, and Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Those are the three markets that we will buy in. If it's not in those three markets, we will not even think about it. No, we don't want it. And it's not because those are the only good markets in the U.S. It's because that's where my scale is. That's where my other assets are. That's where my team is. That's where my people are, you know? I think it's very important to scale in whatever market. I don't care if you're buying apartment buildings or single family homes or self-storage, it is important to have markets that you are willing to really hunker down in and get to know everything there is to know about. So
I think real quick, before you continue, Matt, I really want to emphasize this for people. We're talking about somebody who has nearly 2000 or going to be 2000, units, apartments. And we're talking about you investing in three markets in the United States. If mm-hmm. you think a lot of people thinking like, if you pigeonhole yourself to such a small area, you can't win in that area, but you only invest in three markets and won't look elsewhere. And you still have been able to amass 2000. So it's like, this is possible if you really focus on a niche and understand your specific target market and area. So
you got to pick the right city too. You got to pick the right market, right? So if you want to own mid-sized multi, if that's where you want to be, then pick the market that has a lot of mid-sized multis. Like we got started in Trenton, New Jersey. Very different market. Not a lot of mid-sized multi, not a lot of garden low rise, a lot of affordable housing, a lot of infill stuff. And there's a lot of good deals you can still get on infills in Trenton, but not a market that you can scale and take down big assets in. So we outgrew Trenton in a lot of ways. But that was our first home as a company for a long time.
Got it. So we were talking about your multifamily kind of mm-hmm. venture and your scaling. I guess maybe talk about the properties that you're doing now and how you're able to kind of, as you like, the growth that you've had. What's the biggest thing that you're focused on at this moment now?
I mean, where we're, it's like, you got to do good deals. You got to be really careful deals you do. It's not like kid in a candy store, buy anything on the shelf or whatever. I mean, you got to be really careful what you get yourself into. So short answer is that like, we're still buying. I mean, we have five under contract now that we're buying, five apartment buildings, but, those were well, I'll tell you a story. Those five that we're buying, we underwrote, meaning like evaluated considered and ran the numbers on like 230 deals last year. Of those 230 deals, we made 50 offers, meaning like 180 of them were so bad. We're like, man, I ain't gonna bother. Right. That's just a piece of garbage. You know, you can have that. Right. Or just not nowhere close to what they're asking. So forget it. So of those 50, right, we got into negotiations and best and final considerations and whatever on about half of that. And we landed 9 of those. Right. So those are the numbers that it takes to do deals. And that's in like a handful of markets. Right. Yep. You know,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you could, now let's transition back a little bit to private money, and just on an elementary level, can you break it down for listeners? Like, what is private money? And then who are the players in a private money deal? I know you have the deal provider and the cash provider, and then just like trickle us all the way through and how potentially someone could lock one of these deals up.
Warms my heart, Ryan, to hear you using my lingo from my book.
There you go.
Appreciate you. Thank you.
Appreciate you.
Private capital breaks down to 2 things, right? It breaks down to money and time, right? And the time side of it is someone who's putting in like the legs. It's us, right? It's the 3 of us that's out there doing the deals, the hustler, making it happen, finding the opportunities. It also has a Rolodex and the contacts and knows good neighborhoods, bad neighborhoods, all that stuff, right? There's a lot that we bring into the table. So that's the deal provider. And the cash provider typically is somebody who just either doesn't realize that real estate is a good place for them to invest, you know, or just wants to make a rate of return on their money outside of Wall Street, and is willing to trust that deal provider. And not every cash provider is a good one, mind you, Ryan, in that like I've dealt with plenty of bad ones. And these are the bad ones are ones that want to get into the mix and want to like tell you how it's going to go and direct you and help you call the shots and stuff like that. I mean, it's different than partnership, but they still have to trust that you're going to do 95% of the work and they can't be your boss. They're not your boss. You're not beholden to them. You're partnering with them. So it takes a good marriage. And in the book, I talk about that too, about a bad capital raiser or a bad cash provider or a bad deal provider. So
absolutely. Yeah. Cool. Thank you for that. And then, so what we always get asked this as well is like, what are the best investment strategies to fund a private capital deal, right? It doesn't work for every single deal I'm thinking a BRRRR is a perfect strategy, right? Yeah. Then there's fix and flip syndications. Are those the 3 main pillars or are there other ways as well? I'm thinking like a long-term rental. Mm-hmm. How would you recommend that? Like if someone just wanted to go in on a duplex with someone, but they don't want to fork up all this equity, is there a play in that at all?
Sure. If it's a BRRRR deal. Yeah. But the problem is that a couple of questions there. There is equity, there's a loan, and there's a hybrid of the two. The hybrid of the two is called a joint venture. So those are the 3 ways you can structure money. And there's all kinds of different hybrids and spins or whatever. But at the end of the day, it's either you are lending me money, you are partnering with me with your money, or we're doing a bit of a mix, right? In the market, like a little while ago, doing BRRRR deals or whatever was more prevalent because things like the beat up property was appropriately priced. But because the market's taken off, I'll try and throw some real Philly numbers out there, although it's been a while since I've invested in Philly, so I probably missed the mark, right? But I'll give you Philly back in my day when I used to invest in Philadelphia. That we would buy like a shell, like a complete beat up property that, you know, needed to be gutted and turned around for like, you know, 50 to 75 grand, needed 100 grand worth of work to do a complete gut. So your all in exposure is 175 and you could sell it for 250 to 300, or you could lease it for 2 grand, you know, that deal works all day long. Right. Or you could do 1 + 1 = 3. That's what we used to do in Philly. So 100,000 plus 100,000 in rental equals 300,000 in value and you're done. Right. Now it's like, you know, 250 plus 100 equals, you know, 6 or something like that.
I was going to say those $100,000 properties or $75,000 properties are like just land now, if that, you can't, I mean, it would be in the worst possible area that you maybe would hold it for 10, 15 years and hope, but
with an underground oil tank on the land too, or something like
exactly,
that.
Exactly.
Right? For a former gas station. Yeah. Right.
Right.
So yeah, again, numbers change, but it doesn't matter. It's not like, oh, I can't buy that property for 75 anymore, so I can't do BRRRR. All that matters is you know, what is the bank going to look at the property for when I'm done? And to back into it. If to Ryan, all the way back to your point, if you can do a confident BRRRR deal to get the debt out, I would every day 100% do a private loan or maybe a JV to get the invest. And once the investor gets their capital back, they get a little bit of ownership, but you don't want to get diluted in that. And so as best you can, you want to do deals where the private lender, they make what they make and you've got the opportunity to get them out, or the private investor, whether they're equity or debt or whatever it is, especially on smaller deals, you want to be able to get them out of the deal as soon as you can, right? So that you can enjoy that cash flow yourself, but B, so they got all their capital back and what are they going to do with it? Well, geez, I just made 9-10% investing with Ryan. Let me do that deal again. That's amazing. I'll do that again. And I'll tell all my downline about it. Right. When we were doing a lot of infill like that, we made a living on doing private loans because some investors love that, especially if they have an IRA. A private, you cannot beat a private, a IRA investment in a private loan. Because they don't need the tax write-offs that you get from equity. They're getting their money back and the interest, they can parlay the interest on top of it. So they can just snowball their money. It's amazing.
Can you give us an example? Maybe let's just say a hypothetical deal with numbers so someone can get this in their head. But like from an IRA, like how does someone leverage someone else's retirement account to put into a deal? And even if you want to give us round numbers, just sure, how that whole process even works.
Sure. I'll give you a lot there. And my YouTube channel has a video on something called the Rule of 72, right? And so yep, they should go to YouTube and my YouTube channel, DeRosa Group, youtube.com/DeRosa Group, and look up the Rule of 72 video. Rule 72 works like this, and it only works in an IRA. It does not work with a cash investor, and that's because the cash investor has to pay tax every time you give them their money back, right? IRA investor does not. So let's say somebody gives you $100,000 for a private loan in your deal. You strike a deal at 10% interest, which is common. And just for simple math, we're not going to do any points, okay? You keep the money for 6 months. So it's $5,000 that you owe in interest, right? Simple interest, $5,000. So you've given them back $105,000 now. Now that $105,000, because they didn't pay tax on it, that $105,000 is now all in play for the next deal. So the way that the snowball builds, it's like start with $100,000. Yeah, they give you, you give them back $105,000. They give you $105,000 for your next deal. You give them back $112,000. Yep. They give you $112,000 for your next deal. You give them back $122,000. Right. And before you know it, they're over and over and over again. And they're taking advantage of the Rule 72. If you take 72 and divide it by the interest rate on a compounding loan, which is that's what you're doing. You're compounding that interest, taking the interest that you're giving them and they get to lend that interest back to you. That's called compounding, right? You're making money on your returns. So if I take 72 and divide it by the interest rate on a compounding loan, that is how long it takes the money to double. So if I'm at 10%, I'm at 7.2, and that's if I'm compounding annually. So if you're giving their money back to them sooner than a year, then it compounds faster than that. Think about that. Somebody with a retirement account can double up, especially in today's economy where the stock market's a little bit towards the top, right? So to your, so that's the Rule 72, and that's how it works, and that's why it's amazing. And the way that you carry this conversation forward is you find somebody in your network and you teach them about the Rule 72, and anybody that, you know, bottom line as well, anybody in your network that used to have a job working at company A and now works at company B has a retirement account from company A. And that retirement account could be an IRA. And we all know people, the average American switches jobs every 7 years, right? So anybody that used to work at company A that now works at company B is a potential IRA lender. There are so many people out there. And one last thing, I know I'm doing a lot of talk and I apologize.
Oh, it's great.
I love teaching this stuff. There's like 10 trillion in IRAs right now, trillion with a T, right? Of that money, the last time I read up on this was from Quest. They gave me a stat on this, is 4% of that money is invested in anything else aside from Wall Street.
Wow. That is, right. And that's still a ton of money, the 4%, but 10 trillion. That's incredible.
It's a shit ton that's invested. It's like 400 billion or something like that. That's in other Wall Street stuff, but look at how much we could move the needle. If we all could move that to 5 or 6 or whatever, there's so much more money that could get freed up to all help us build our businesses. And I think that, the stock market hiccups the wrong way, more and more people are going to say, you know what, man, screw this. I'm not dealing with the stock market, the roulette wheel of Wall Street, not dealing with it. I'm going to find another way. And we could be the other way, you know, the three of us. Yep. And your listeners can be the other way to help people hit their financial goals by helping us rehab properties in our own neighborhoods.
Awesome. So if you were using what you know to teach people how to find deals now in today's market, because it's very, very different than it was when you were starting out, or even as you went through the process, how would you recommend to people to find these deals in today's market to try to use other people's money to scale your portfolio?
It goes back to Ryan's comment about Burr, or, you know, whatever it is. You guys, your listeners need to like realize that private capital is it's a toolbox to reach into, and there's different tools in the box. It's like, okay, I got this beater that I got at the foreclosure auction, you know, or a wholesaler sold it to me. That's literally like a shell in the path of progress, good area. Maybe I'm going to flip it. Maybe I want to rent it depending on what my desires are for my income. But either way, I believe that I could get in, add value, and that value I've added, I can reap that out and then some if I refinance it. And that's a Burr deal. And that is a loan all day long, right? So that's equation one. And if you find, okay, here's a 5-unit apartment building, you know, or a 4-unit apartment building that I can buy. And it's an emerging market. It's in a good area. Rents are a little low, right? Maybe I can get in and add some value and increase rents, increase common areas, make the property feel safer for the tenants where they're willing to compensate me for what I've done to the property. So I can buy it for, you know, $600K and make it worth $800 in a year, right?
Right.
Maybe that's something that I could play a joint venture on, or just trade equity, whatever it is. You got to just look for deals that are in line with your business plan and just have a couple of different ways you can structure equity to make the deal, to structure your private investors to make that deal work. That's what I recommend.
So with that, that kind of segues into my next question is like, when you're preparing a deal to present to someone, we've been recommended a few different things. I want to get your thoughts on this. Mm-hmm. Do you have a business plan prepared, like a brochure? And if so, what's in that to say like, hey, let's just say your father-in-law, I know it probably changed from then till now, but like if you're going into a new prospective cash provider and you're, how do you get them to say, yeah, sure, take my money. Here you go. I trust you.
Right. That's the mark right there. Now, like it's raising capital is an art, and it's a muscle you got to flex and just to get more comfortable talking about these things and stuff like that. But the presentations that we use, we're doing different stuff right now. So we're buying big multifamily. So we do a big multifamily PowerPoint presentation. That's like a slide deck kind of thing that we put together. I'm like, hey, here's what it is. We do webinars and all that. So if you're going to present a single deal to a lot of people, you need a single point of attention, you know, webinar deck that says why real estate investing, why Lexington, Kentucky, why our company, why DeRosa Group, and then why that building, right? Answers those questions. That's on the big side. On the smaller side, if you're sitting down with Uncle Charlie and talk to him about why he should partner up with you as a single partnership on the duplex, then there are more touchy-feely, very understandable chart-based calculators out there. Back in the day, I used the Bigger Pockets calculators all the time, and I promise you, they're not sending me a free toaster or anything for mentioning their name, but the Bigger Pockets calculators are very user-friendly. What I like about them is they're not the most robust calculator out there. They're not developed by rocket scientists. They are made for people to anybody to understand. And that's Bigger Pockets' model. It's a very wide space that anybody can do this. That's kind of one of their, you know, like that's what they portray in that. And you can use their calculators and present them to just about anybody. They're very easy to understand. So I recommend the Bigger Pockets calculators for people to use to pitch deals to people. And they got a Burr calculator, a flip calculator, a rental calculator, whatever you want.
Cool. I like that. And then one more is a more personal question. It's like, Sure. How do you get over the fear of asking people for money? I think that's a big stigma around this is like, oh, listen, like,
oh, yeah,
I'm comfortable with this, but I don't know how to reach out to father-in-law, brother, XYZ friend and say, hey, I need you. Can you lend me 100K?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then what's funny is you hear people that aren't comfortable that go under the excuse of, I don't know anybody with money. And that's what they will tell you. But my book will tell you that if you look for the three different sources, cash, retirement account, and real estate, if you use those three to look for, and you use the signals that those things leave in your network, you'll realize it's all around you. The fear is dissolved when you realize this simple fact, and it takes a while to realize it. And you almost need an investor to tell this to you or to signal it to you. And the fact of the matter is they need you just as much as you need them. Right. And a good private lender is going to tell you that, is going to lead into that. Like, man, I don't know what Wall Street's going to do. Stock market may go down tomorrow. I have no idea. Right. And the cocky ones are going to make it look like that they walk on water because they have money and you don't. Right. So I don't work with people like that. Life's too short than to feel like I got a job from my private lender. So I don't work with those guys. I work with win-win arrangements. And so if you want to create win-win, realize they need you just as much as you need them.
Fair enough. Love it. Yeah. And so just to put a bow on this whole thing, I know we walked through all the intricacies of a private money deal. Can you walk us through your first private capital deal and just give us the numbers on it? Like where you bought it, what it, how you found it, everything possible, just to give someone like, hey, the courage that they can go do this. And it's not that complicated.
Yeah. It was, there's a few that I think of out there. There was the deal with the guy that my wife went to college with was the one that was my very first private capital deal that I did with someone that wasn't like, you know, my dad, and that kind of thing. But the numbers are, again, this is like 2011 numbers. Okay, guys. So you'll be jealous. I'll tell you this. These are like 2-bedroom, 1-bath, single family homes, Trenton, New Jersey, like post crash foreclosures, right? That probably valued at 120,000, completely beat up, bought them for 25K a piece from a wholesaler, which means the wholesaler made money selling them to me for 25 grand.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I know. So, So we bought them for 25K a piece. My private equity guy that was my wife's buddy from college fronted that 50K that got us to closing. Then another friend of mine that had a retirement account and he taught me, this guy taught me how to do private loans with an IRA. This is like 2011, 12, man. Nobody was there was no guru running around teaching how to do this stuff, right? My book wasn't out yet, right? So I couldn't read that. This guy had figured out how to do private. He was also a real estate investor and had been borrowing somebody else's IRA for his real estate deals. But you can't lend your IRA to yourself. Your IRA can't touch your own hands. Those that are in the business know that. So he knew he couldn't make money on his IRA. So he sat me down and said, hey, man, listen, this is what I've been doing. This is how it works. Here's the loan documents. I have an IRA. I want to put it to work. Can I work with you? And I said, heck yeah, you can. So we borrowed the construction from him. So he put in 50K in private loans. My buddy put in 50K in equity. I took that 50K in private loans and we did kitchens, bathrooms, exteriors, interiors. Built them like a tank, you guys know how to do it. You had to build rentals like a tank to where pretty much a bomb could go off inside. And it sometimes does and you could still just clean the unit and go in there and power wash it off and it's back in good condition again. Right. So just LVP flooring, lots of semi-gloss paint you can just wipe off and stuff like that. Nice bomb-proof kitchens and everything. So all the way through, did a great reno. 50K a door is what we were in for all in. Came in 2-bedroom, 1-bath. Again, New Jersey numbers, leased them for $950 a piece, right?
Right.
And it was not hard to get the 1.5% to 2% rule back in the day. So leased them out. But here's what was different back then. With the loan, the lending was very, very light. So we were only able to refinance them just enough to get the private loan back and a little bit of the equity. So we were able to refinance it and we got most of the equity back out and we got the private loan out of the deal. So then we were able to cash flow them on a mortgage, just under 100K total. Cash flowed around like $650 a month total, all in. Me and my partner split that 50-50 split. He put all the money in. I did all the work, except for him keeping the books. So he's active. And then we had his 50K back out. Right. So we took that and we put it to work on the next deal. But then he got a few of his other friends to come in, and we went not just two little single family homes. We scaled up and bought a duplex and before you know it, the snowball was rolling because he got a taste and saw, hey, wait a minute. I put in 100K, 50K, and Matt's doing all the work, and I'm getting a nice check every month, and it's like mailbox money, you know? So it was a win-win for us there. And it's content. That investor is still invested with me from that I met 10 years ago.
So that's really how you build that snowball. And that's awesome. And it's good advice for Ryan and I, who are at, like, you know, we just mentioned we're at 7 units, and we're at that point where the snowball's already building, right? But let's really start to build it now, and we can really scale our portfolio.
All you need to go back to 100K, man. It is tempting to go out there and find $500,000 and put it to work and go buy like 4 or 5 deals on it or whatever. That's a sure way to wrap yourself around a tree. Do one deal, document the crap out of it on like shoot YouTube videos. And that's one thing we haven't talked about yet, but you've got to shoot a lot of video and capture a lot of content of your progress, because people will eventually see that content when you put it out on social. I know you guys have a huge Instagram following or whatever. Somebody's going to see
that. Semi-huge. Yeah. It's getting there.
Yeah, you're getting there. You got more than me. It's huge to me. Right?
Hopefully we can help you out with that. But
nice. So that's it. It's just one deal after another. That's what I believe. I believe in one deal after another gets you to the finish line.
The next question that I kind of wanted to get into here is, you mentioned that it's not often that we get to interview somebody who's been investing for as long as you have, right? 20 almost 20 years coming up here, and including, you know, the beginning of your first house hack. What parallels are you seeing from the market in 2004, 2005, 2006 to now? And are you as nervous as some people are about this impending crash? We've talked to a lot of investors, and a lot of them are saying it's not that similar, except for the fact that assets are rising in price and that there's so little inventory that they're not really as concerned about a crash. But I don't know that to be true. You may. So what's your take on it?
I've yet to see what the real linchpins that's going to cause a crash would be, right? I think that you know, if we were all sitting around a casino and we are all sitting around the roulette table and AC together, you know, right now maybe you'd be betting black only because it hasn't hit in a while, right? And it's like, oh well, we haven't had a recession, we haven't had a crash, and so that's why we're due for one. But that makes no sense. There is no financial indicator that points to a crash that I've seen. Now there are things that could happen. You know, rates may creep up, inflation, you know, the stock market might take a dip, employment, you know, whatever. Those things are all indirectly correlated to real estate, but there is nothing that I've seen that points to a 2008 happening again. And that's because 2008 happened because our lending criteria was off. You know, we were lending money on deals that we shouldn't have been. And, you know, we had, if you watch The Big Short, that was really happening. You know, I was subject to that. We were buying properties with like, you know, first and second mortgages, non-owner occupied, like zero money down. Yep. Like 80% first mortgage, 20% second mortgage. And then the first mortgage was a negative amortization, meaning like the amount of money you paid them. Like, so the total interest on the first mortgage would be like $800 a month, right? The neg am says, well, you don't have to pay us that whole 800. You can pay us 600 and we'll take $200 and we'll add it to your principal. Right. And so think about
it. It almost makes no sense how that was, like how people didn't see like, hey, this is not going to work. Like this is insane. Cause I actually know people personally who now look at real estate with a pretty jaded view. They're like, I hate that. I can't believe it. Cause they had no business getting in real estate anyway, just cause they didn't know what they were doing. And then they literally were getting into deals with zero money down back in 2007 and 2008. So.
But don't get me wrong. I did that too. It's because that's what was there.
You know,
that's what we were able to do. That's what the offers were. And we didn't know any better. You know, nobody did, you know, and those people that lost their shirt, we're lucky that we were able to find a way to mitigate through it, during the crash. But I think that we're being way more pragmatic. Things like Dodd-Frank got put in that aren't allowing these lenders to do no doc stuff and everything like that. So I don't see the same tea leaves now. There's different tea leaves, right? Not to like get too politicky or whatever, but we got a lot of social unrest in this country, you know, in the US. So I think that if anything is going to tip a house of cards here, it's going to be a social unrest issue. It's going to be something when nobody's even thinking of, kind of like COVID, right?
Right.
Nobody had COVID in their underwriting, you know, nobody like, hey, what if the whole world shuts down for a year? Right.
No, but it's interesting, Matt, if they did have COVID in their underwriting, they probably wouldn't have thought what was going to happen with it actually did, which is even crazier, right?
We're like, yeah, it's like we're all dreaming right now in what's been happening. And so honestly, I really have no idea what's going to happen tomorrow. But what I can, and what I can tell you this, right? Because I did invest a lot in 2000, going into 2008, and we didn't lose anything. And that's because every deal that we did, we made sure it cash flowed. And I had buddies that were buying properties that were in the red, that were losing $300 to $400 a month buying real estate going into the crash. And they only bought because they wanted to ride appreciation.
Yep.
Like, oh, well, it'll go up in value and, you know, I'll get that money back or whatever. They lost their ass, those guys, you know. We were able to, and that's like we're any better. We just had different terms. And it's because I'm a Kiyosaki student, and Kiyosaki was all about cash flow as the number one requirement for a real estate investing deal.
Right.
And so we invested for cash flow. And so if values get cut in half, if stock market, social unrest or whatever happens, right? If you invest for cash flow and if your deal makes money today, right? It will likely continue to do that tomorrow, no matter what. Even if you buy a property, and we did this. I had properties that we bought for 100 and overnight it was worth 50, you know, right? Well, because it cash flowed, I was able to keep cash flowing it. And that property was supposed to be something I was going to hold for a year, ended up holding it for 9, you know, but guess what? I didn't lose it. I held it. I made money when I sold it, you know?
Yep.
So it just changes your business plan, but cash flow allows you to hold your breath a lot longer. And through any downturn,
Matt, so. And just to put some context on that, I think people were like, well, how do you guarantee that if it cash flows at the beginning that it's going to continue? But I think the answer to that is like, if you look at a chart of the United States, and I don't have this like factually in front of me, but just a lot of investors that I've talked to, even though the values of the properties dropped, as long as you're holding, the rents didn't do the same thing. There was not this correlation between it's not like you rented out a property for $2,000, the market went down, and then your tenants are like, oh, I think it should only pay $1,000. Like that doesn't work like that. And I heard that rents stayed steady, and in some places just continued to rise like they always did in 2008 and 2009.
C-class rents did. C and B class rents did. If you're playing bougie A class rent stuff with like an iPad mounted in the wall and you're charging people in Philly $3,500 a month for their rent, those people, if there's a major stock pullback, right, those people may lose their jobs, right? But I will go head to head that my auto mechanic making $45,000 a year living in my rental property will find another job faster than your banker making $150,000 a year living in your $3,500 a month rental unit.
And now I remembered why reading your book, which is what we're going to get into next, Raising Private Capital, building your empire, building your real estate empire by using other people's money.
Yes.
Reminded us to buy. I guess we typically say B or B minus, but like in that middle range where it's like, okay, people have room to go down. People have room to go up if they make more money, but you're not at the tip of the iceberg. So I love that strategy. Yeah.
That's why all we'll buy is because it's, I have found it to be more recession proof, and people are like, well, you know, there's different stability metrics and things like that. And those tenants are hand to mouth or whatever. The government throws more money at them during a recession. They did during COVID. They got more money than the guy making 150 grand a year did that lost his job too, you know?
Yep.
And that's, but I believe the top topples first. And I was around in 2007 and 8. Miami and Vegas were the best markets to invest in ever. Then the crash happened. Those markets took a dive. Now they're back up at the top again, you know? But that's interesting, isn't it? You know, that's where they were at the top. Then they fell off the map and now they're rebuilding again. But if you look at markets that are boring, you know, they didn't really take much of a dip one way or the other, you know?
Got it.
So yeah. I'm not about chasing appreciation. Appreciation is bonus, like whipped cream and a cherry on top of the ice cream, you know? But there's people that invest for appreciation, and you can invest for appreciation But if that's your only investment strategy, then when that goes away, and appreciation is something you can't control, right? And if you're investing on something you can't control, then you got to cross your fingers and hope. But cash flow is something you can control.
And if you're going to do that, Matt, you might as well just invest in the stock market. If you're going to cross your fingers and hope, I mean, there's no point to, in my opinion. But great, man. So we're kind of winding the show down a little bit. I want to talk about your book. And I mentioned, you know, raising private capital, building your real estate empire, using other people's money. Can you talk about the inspiration behind writing it? Because there's one thing to be using other people's money and building this portfolio that way, but then to write a book on it, like, you know, you kind of have to also, one, really know what you're doing, but then have the connections to even do so. So can you talk about your book a little bit here?
Sure. I'd love to. And they can pick up a copy of it on Bigger Pockets. And see, this is like, I'm dating myself, and this is something y'all have already figured out a long time ago, but I just got myself a little link bio thing in my Instagram bio. But I went to the Matt Faircloth. They can click on the link in my bio and they can go and pick up a copy of my book. They can register for the Bigger Pockets Bootcamp that I'm going to be teaching on multifamily investing starting February 3rd of 2022. And that's, they can register for that. And they can also check out some investments that we have for accredited investors. Anyway, my book, that is my labor of love. It is a book that I worked very hard on that I'm very proud of and very happy with. And it's a book that I'm proud to say is an Amazon bestseller. And it's a great asset that I'd like to thank for those that I just taught a lot of what I've learned in just, it's a book I wish was written when I first got started on how to do this thing of real estate investing with other people's money.
Awesome. That's a great plug. I think Ryan and I have both read it, and it helped frame, if there's a number of things that I took from it personally, which was going in that middle ground CB class markets. That was one of the things I took. I honestly forgot where I got that from until I started talking to you today. Yep. That, and then just the structure of how you really scale a rental portfolio. And the good news is here, Matt, is I'm glad you plugged the, you said it was a webinar, correct? Is that what you said?
That's a full course, the boot camp. It's a 12-week boot camp, and they price it really, really reasonably. Bigger Pockets is not greedy. I think it's $450 or something like that that it's priced at for a 12-week class with networking, handouts, homework every week, video interaction with me and my team, and everything like that. So it's a phenomenal program, and it's selling out quick. So folks should check it out.
Listening to this episode, hopefully there's still some available, because our episode, this is the 26th of January or later when you're listening to this, hopefully there's still some availability. Great. I hope people know, sign up. So
we have that also in our Amazon store via our link tree as well, under our favorite real estate investing books. So please, just so you know, you can get in both places if you can't figure out how to find us on Instagram. But
go to Ryan and Corey's link tree and buy that book. Thank you guys for putting that on your link tree. I really appreciate that.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure. And we stand by it. It's an incredible book. I've used this as a tool. Like I said, we've helped answer other people's questions based on this book. Now we have the pro, the all-star in person. So it's even better. But I did have a quick question. I'm sure people are intrigued. How did you get connected with Bigger Pockets in general and to get them to publish your book?
I've been writing articles for them since 2003. I wrote the book in 2018. Liz, just my wife, just happened to cold call them when they were a much smaller organization. I think that they're now obviously an enormous juggernaut of real estate. But they were not just getting going. They were, much smaller, and Liz called them, to set up an interview, and we interviewed with Brandon, you know, and then what's funny is the whole time on the interview where he's interviewing us to write articles, I keep calling it Better Pockets. Right. And I looked down at my cell phone and she is blowing me up in big capital letters going, "Fool, it is Bigger Pockets," you know, and stuff like that. Luckily enough, Brandon has a sense of humor and still gave us a shot. And so Liz and I wrote articles for them for like a year and a half, every week, just about everything we learned about real estate. And then they gave us a shot on the podcast in 2014, 2015, somewhere in there. And that changed our life, you know, going on the Bigger Pockets podcast. And then we've just continued to work with them and had good relations with them and, you know, never let them down. They never let us down. And then in 2017, they asked me about writing a book, and we pitched them on Raising Private Capital. They loved it. And so it got published in August of 18. in that. So it was something I just, it's not like we just walked in the door and said, we want to write a book about raising money and we want you guys to, I guess what I give people that want to write a book for a big organization like BiggerPockets, you got to put one foot in front of the other. And people just don't want to do that these days. They want to have their big hit right now. I want it today. And you're not going to get that. You got to prove yourself to people and put one foot in front of the other. And before you know it, you'll realize how far down the road you are. There's a great book called The Gap and the Gain. That's the darling right now. It's a great book. That's about just looking how far you've come in that. So that was the BiggerPockets journey. And it was one step in front of the other. And over years, we developed a lot of relationship and faith with them. And they give us a crack at a book years after our relationship started.
That's really cool. Really, really interesting. Well, thank you. Proof's in the pudding. It's people always do want to, like you said, just instant gratification, be at the end of the rainbow here, but you got to work up to it. So really cool. With that, we've kind of winded down the show. We come to our second to last segment, and it's called the Core Four. And first question of the Core Four, we'll keep it easy for you. And you can't cheat and use your own book outside of your book. What is your favorite or one of your favorite real estate investing or business books that has helped you kind of propel your career?
I mentioned it earlier, but that would just be Rich Dad, Poor Dad. The Gap and the Gain is a great mindset book I'm reading right now. So I'd point to that as well. And I would also point to another one just because you probably get a lot of people saying Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And Gap and Gain, I'm not quite done yet. It's also a mindset book for a core business book for somebody looking that's had some successes and is looking to go to the next level for their business. I recommend a book called Traction. For small to mid-sized companies, on how to get to next level. So
cool. Love it. Yeah. Love it. So question number two, and we realize when we ask this question, we're dealing with people from all different places in their business. So let's just say that $50,000 was a decent amount of money to you. If you had an extra 50 grand, let's just say you're whatever place in your business that you were going to be, it's not necessarily continuing income, but let's just say somebody gives you 50 grand. What would you do with it today?
If I had 50 grand right now, there's easy answers. Like I would invest it in my business, which I probably would, or, you know, in one of my deals or something like that. But if I had 50 grand that I couldn't invest in anything that I'm touching and had to go 100% passive on it, I likely would put it into a flex industrial operator that I believe in, you know, because I believe flex industrial is the dark horse part of real estate that nobody's talking about that is going to be what is a major blow up in real estate that's going to take off and become 10x value and become something that's pursued quite a bit. If I had to keep the money in real estate,
you have to tell us what that is.
That don't know flex industrial.
For anyone out there that's wondering that has no clue, know. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Flex industrial is, it is the reason I call it flex is it's got like a small warehouse, like a 3,000 to 4,000 square foot space attached to an office. Right. So you can take a guy making widgets that is going to get a little team going and they're going to blow up the phones and sell the widgets that are housed in the warehouse right behind them. There is a ton of people selling things online on Amazon, whatever. Flex Industrial used to be like the house of small construction companies and stuff like that, but now it's become the home of all things online sales. And the retail strip centers are going to be replaced by people selling things online sales, not just Amazon, but by all online businesses. Need a place to keep their stuff and they need a place to sell their stuff and meet with teams and whatever it is. So those spaces are called flex industrial. And there are companies out there that own them or that are developing them or are repositioning existing industrial sites and building little office spaces and cutting up little cubes of warehouse space. So if I were to do that, I think that is where the growth of America is going to be. Is in little online, small, like 5 to 10 employee companies, but there's going to be a bajillion of them that they're going to come on and they're going to change every space there is to change in the world over the next say 5 years.
Wow. Really cool. Love it. Thank you for that.
Sure, man.
So question number three is, what has been your biggest mistake that you've made in your investing career and how have you learned from it?
Oh man, I've done, I'm in a ton. I mostly is I looked before I leapt before I looked, on a lot of different things. And I got into things without vetting them soon enough. And my wife and I have gotten involved, in like bad deals or bad partnerships or whatever it is by jumping to step five on the road when we should have been at step one, two, three. So we, you know, just got further down the road and didn't really just have faith in the process for things to evolve and just jumped in and made decisions for things that should have been vetted a little bit harder, than that. Cause we're quick starts and that's, we just jump in and make things happen. And so we've jumped into snake pits before. So I would say the mistake that I've made in general, not like specific story wise, but the mistake that we made in general was jumping into things too fast.
That's tough for an entrepreneur to not mm-hmm. do. So mm-hmm. I hear you on that. Mm-hmm. I think, my quick starts, I don't know if you're talking about Colby, but my quick start is a 9. Yes. So yeah, yep. I'm the same way. And, Rye is a high quick start too, but he definitely protects me, in
all entrepreneurs are areas. Most yeah. good entrepreneurs are good quick starts. Cause you can't see all the what ifs and all the fear and all that. You got to just see the possibilities, but quick starts are also subject to jumping into things way too quick. And I recommend everybody take the Colby, everybody that jump out there and do it. And the guy that wrote Traction is a student of Colby as well. He brings a lot of that technology.
Just to give people some background on the Colby, it's like it's sort of like a work, maybe Matt can explain it better than me, but it's like a working business type of analysis of the type of person that you would be in your career. And it can help give you ideas.
Personality assessment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's
it's KOLBE for those listening. KOLBE costs like $50 to take it. There's a great tutorial on how to read it in there, and there's no wrong answers when you take the survey. It's a good thing you should take with your spouse, you should take with your business partners, and that's I'm glad you picked up on that. But yeah, that I'm like a 9 out of 10 up there too, in quick start on Colby as well.
Yeah, so. Awesome. So last question on the core four. We love this question. Well, what do you want your legacy to be, Matt? Why do you wake up every day? Why do you continue to do this? It's not easy. Although you make it seem easy. So what do you want your legacy?
I didn't get a chance to talk about this, but my mantra for my company, the mission of my company is to transform lives through real estate. And it sounds like this, you know, hokey, not-for-profit thing, but I believe that real estate really touches so many lives. It has the opportunity to make an impact on a lot of people and in a lot of people's lives. And so I firmly believe that what we do at DeRosa Group can transform the lives of many, many people. And so if I know that it's not about how much money I made, if I made enough money to give a great life to my kids and my family and to enjoy some of the money I make with my family too, then that's enough. But beyond that, I want to make enough money that I can really recycle it and make a difference with it too, but also make the investments that we make and the properties we rehab and the people that work on those properties and the employees and the staff and the tenants all get a life upgrade by interacting with the DeRosa Group. If I can create that, then I'm all in. If that's the legacy that I know of, then I'm in for doing that. So it goes back to just making the world a better place, Corey.
So really quick, thank you for that answer. That's sure. awesome. I absolutely sure. love it. Where does the name DeRosa derive from? Like, how does that popular? I'm seeing Faircloth everywhere, but.
Yeah, no, it's my wife's mother's maiden name. It's my wife's very, very, very Italian. So it's, Paisan from a Paisan family from Brooklyn, kind of name and everything like that, that we thought was strong, like Stumbats, like Tony Soprano kind of thing. And that, so we just thought it had a lot of character and a lot of push to it. And so, yeah, our name is Matt Faircloth and she's Liz Faircloth. She runs the Real Estate Investor podcast and has an enormous community of women that are students of hers. I think it's like 12 or 13,000 of them or something like that. So she's got her own thing going as well, but our brand is the DeRosa Group for our real estate investing company.
Really, really incredible. Love it.
Mm-hmm. So we've made it to the last drop. And the last drop is our last question of the show. You get it, the juice to drop. Yeah, there you go. What advice would you give your younger self if you can go back to, maybe 20-year-old Matt and why?
I quit my job in 2005. So I would say my 29-year-old Matt, because that's when I quit my job. I would say stay focused, because I tried a lot of different real estate ventures. I, you know, got involved in things I shouldn't have. And I see where my life would have gone and the walls I would not have bumped into and the mistakes I would have made had I just stayed focused in my business. Just pick a lane, pick a market, pick a real estate type and stay and stick with it for 5 years, 10 years, you know, and just give it a shot no matter what, make it work. But I dated around, tried a lot of things, and messed around with it a lot before I finally found residential housing as my home and my niche. And just, I'm going to stay with that kind of thing. So
love it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Matt, incredible show. If people loved the interview, loved you, they want to network, get to know you a little bit better, where can they find you?
Yeah. Instagram, the Matt Faircloth. DeRosaGroup.com, DeRosaGroup.com. They can check us out there. Because we talked a lot about Instagram today, just as you go to Insta and click on my, the link in my bio where they can pick up that course for Bigger Pockets. You can go to your Instagram and pick up a copy of my book. And they can check out if they're accredited, they can check out some deals we have on the market right now. So.
Cool. Once again, check out the Matt Faircloth on Instagram. We'll make sure to link everything in the show notes. But Matt, thank you so much. Incredible episode. It was a pleasure getting to know you. And thanks for dropping a whole hell of a lot of knowledge on us. I feel more prepared going into deals.
Yeah, go make it happen, Ryan and Corey. Great to meet you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in this week. If you enjoyed the show and like what you heard, please subscribe, share with friends, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. The more ratings we get, the more eyes we'll get on our show. And in turn, we'll be able to provide you all with high quality guests. It's simple. Open your podcast app, type in our podcast name, The Weekly Juice, click on reviews, and let us know what you think. Thanks so much and see you next week.